ever been in a relationship that felt hurtful, even harmful, and yet carried no physical scars? Today's guest says that this is very common, unfortunately, and that we all have a story to share. I am very pleased to introduce to you Shannon Thomas, who is a licensed clinical social worker and the author of Healing from Hidden Abuse, A Journey Through the Stages of Recovery from Psychological Abuse. Shannon Thomas, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much. I've been really looking forward to getting a chance to chat with you and your listeners.
Now, Shannon, you and I, as clinicians, both know that psychological abuse is, you know, it's not necessarily something that people understand, acknowledge. So it's sort of, you know, it gets complicated when you talk about psychological abuse. And many people don't even realize that they are being psychologically abused. Would you say that that's an accurate description?
Absolutely, 100%. And that's why I titled the book Healing from Hidden Abuse, because I was really pondering, okay, how do I put into words exactly what this is? Because it's very cryptic, it's very shadow, but yet it's there. And once we can describe it, it's incredible how people are able to see exactly what they were unable literally to see right before. But yes, it is very difficult to describe unless you have the exact wordage and the education behind it to be able to understand. Okay, that's not normal. That's actually now going into abuse, whatever behavior it may be.
And in fact, you make the point very early on in Healing from Hidden Abuse that psychological abuse is not really talked about in the media, in society, and not really even in the medical field, unless it's someone who perhaps has a particular area of expertise, which is truly problematic, at least from my perspective. You also make the point that psychological abuse is something that can impact everyone. It crosses gender lines, age lines, race, religion, you name it.
Absolutely. And what happens is, I mean, we've heard from folks all over the world, literally, in all different corners of the world, that psychological abuse is happening. So it's not even a construct of our society or our culture. It's the tearing down, manipulation, control of another person through overt or covert mind games. That happens everywhere. It can happen in families, in places of worship. It can happen among friends. I mean, it really is so widespread and yet so misunderstood, even within the mental health community, because I don't know about your education program, but mine barely touched it, barely even touched the diagnoses of the abusers and the people who would perpetrate this. So we never got into the recovery of the victims. So it's something we've had to really look at postgraduate, and once we're in practice and realize that there's something else going on in kind of a percentage within our population of our clients that we were not trained to really adequately assess or treat.
Who are the psychological abusers? Are they aware? That's question number one. And I guess a follow-up question would be, are they aware of the abuse in which they are engaging?
I truly believe they are, and for me, my writing encompasses those folks that would qualify as narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder. And when we look at the criteria and we look at the way that these folks behave, they are very aware of their actions. You know, they're not having any sort of psychosis. There's nothing happening where out of touch with reality, because they're able to turn it on and turn it off for different scenarios, different settings. It takes quite a high level of sophistication in order to manipulate people in the way that they're able to construct. So yes, for me, I believe it is 100% awareness of what they're doing. It just works for them. If everything's all about them and they had lack attachments at some core level, then they're out running amok and are perfectly fine with it because it feeds them.
You've just mentioned two different diagnoses, so I'm just going to ask you to give a thumbnail sketch, if that's possible, of narcissistic personality disorder as the first one that you indicated, and then the second one.
Sure. Narcissistic personality disorder is really, there's some criteria, and people can look it up online at the DSM-5, and it really is about that lack of empathy, Sometimes it's grandiose. I do believe grandiosity is within all of abusers that have a narcissistic personality disorder, but sometimes it can come across very covert. And so there are some diagnostic criteria that fit that personality disorder, and a lot of it has to do with lack of empathy, lack of attachments, grandiosity, seeing themselves as elevated above other people, even though that may manifest a little bit different in the way they present it, their kind of behind-the-scenes belief is always the same. And then antisocial personality is taking that to an extreme. That's taking it to a higher level of intensity. So what I always say is that the narcissist will jokingly run you over and complain about the damage you did to their car. The sociopath will run someone over, this is all metaphorical, and run someone over and kind of get a little glimmer about the damage that they did. And the psychopath is intentionally trying to harm somebody and will back up. So it's all about the spectrum of intensity.
Is it the case that everyone with a narcissistic personality disorder or an antisocial personality disorder is going to engage in psychological abuse with the people around them?
Yes, I do believe so, because there's no way for them to fit the criteria. And I have a real pet peeve a little bit. I'll just plug it in that we are not all a little narcissistic. There's no such thing for me as a clinician of healthy narcissism. We have healthy self-esteem. We have healthy, you know, boundaries, other things. But somebody who fits that criteria, even if they were never officially diagnosed as NPD or antisocial personality, they can't turn it on and turn it off. So they engage in the world within that criteria, within that way of relating to other people. So it is all the time, but that's how they behave. Now, they may turn it on and turn it off depending on how much they want to impress the person or if that person's in power and they're trying to win them over. But yes, they operate all the time in that function.
Well, that sounds kind of scary. So if you know by some stretch that the person who you're interested in has been identified as someone with, let's say, narcissistic personality disorder, is there no hope? I mean, do you run from that relationship quick, fast, in a hurry?
Well, I think most people don't know ahead of time, because folks with NPD will target individuals, and they target folks with strengths. The kind of misunderstanding is that they will target people who are weak or sort of easy to manipulate, and that does nothing for the narcissist's ego. The narcissist or sociopath or psychopath will identify and target those folks that have strength to be kind of grow the sunshine from them or that makes them look good, and then the narcissist or sociopath will then set out to tear down those strengths of their target. So most folks have no idea, I would say almost all, have no idea that the person that they're about to engage in, whether it's romantic or even within their family coming to an awareness or in a workplace, they have no clue, because a lot of times these folks, these toxic individuals, will be very outgoing, very gregarious, very helpful, because there's kind of a honeymoon love bombing stage in the beginning. So there really is no way to, in the beginning, know who's going to be this personality type. But once you have education, then you can really start to put the pieces together quickly. Okay, this person is not safe emotionally.
And, you know, I think about the folks who may have just secured employment, and they're really excited because their supervisor is just warm and wonderful and engaging and everything else. And then they get there and they see the other side. You know, that sounds like a very stuck place to be.
It can be, but I think awareness is really empowering. So, you know, we talk about psychological abuse being difficult to describe like air. You know, it's hard to describe air. But once we have the language and the education, and that's why I put education as stage two of the recovery, because we immediately have to come out of despair, which is stage one, which is what is happening to me, what have I gotten myself into, or what has this person done, into education. Okay, how do I put words to what they're doing? So in the case of a workplace abuse, being able to understand, okay, that person just gaslighted me, that person's using, you know, brainwashing techniques, that person's backstabbing, really being able to identify it and then be proactive to take protective measures, to document well, to engage with HR if needed. And then there's some tools that can, you know, really help folks be able to keep themselves safe. But we can't be in denial that we may be around a psychological abuser.
Now, you have talked in your book about your own experiences with psychological abuse. Can you share with us a little bit of your experience?
Sure. You know, I think once you've come to an awareness of what this looks like, you start to look back and there is a spectrum of these behaviors. And for me, I experienced it most intensely growing up. My childhood is kind of cut into two times. It was pre my father's passing and post my father's passing. And after his death was really when I experienced the most intense psychological abuse, still living with my mom at that point. And so there's a lot of, we call them survivors or thrivers, who experience psychological abuse in the family setting. And that's a different type of recovery. Sometimes we really have to recognize, okay, I can't remember a time when I wasn't within that kind of scope of being manipulated or having an abuser. So it's a constructing for the first time, self-esteem and boundaries. For someone who grew up in a home that was safe and, you know, healthy, and we're all kind of weird in our own ways, but, you know, within a context of normal, and maybe met an abuser in a relationship or at work or in a religious setting, they then think, okay, I need to get back to who I was. Or somebody, you know, but when you're in childhood abuse, that really is like a whole new foundation that you have to create. And so for me, it really started from there. It started from recognizing what I grew up in and then moving forward. And then there's other psychological abusers that I have unfortunately met along the way of life. But once we have recovery, once we identify them, we're very quickly able to set the necessary boundaries.
You talk about the six stages of healing. Go through the stages, just identify the stages by name, if you will, and then we'll begin to talk about them in more detail.
Sure. Stage one is what I call despair. Stage two is education. Stage three is awakening. Stage four is boundaries. Stage five is restoration. And stage six is maintenance. And what I came from is I've been working with clients for a number of years as a clinician and in this area of specialty. And this was sort of the roadmap and the process that I realized that all of the clients went through, regardless of the location of their psychological abuse or the environment. And then I was real fortunate to be able to do a research project with Texas Christian University's Department of Social Work. And through the research project, this also emerged as the pattern that people go through when they're walking out of this type of abuse.
Let's talk about despair for a second. I mean, are you saying that it is the realization of the pain that you're in, or what exactly do you mean by despair as the first stage of healing?
Yeah, most people come into counseling not aware of what they've gone through. It can either be that they're having some intense anxiety or depression, or they're physically starting to shut down, they're having some health issues. A lot of folks will come in feeling very responsible. You know, I'm in this relationship and this person keeps telling me all the terrible things I'm doing and how awful I am. And, you know, the psychological abusers always use a little bit of truth. We all have areas of growth. And so these manipulators will use a little bit of truth and then put poison with it, you know, their own lies and perceptions, so that the survivor will take it in. And there is a personality type that we've seen that a lot of survivors, you know, fit a certain Myers-Briggs personality. They fit a certain perspective, which is, I will be, you know, happy to look at myself. There's kind of an easygoing nature of a lot of people that get, unfortunately, in these relationships with abusers, because that easy nature is taken advantage of, you know, that kind of forgiving nature. And so despair really looks very hard. It looks, you know, people having high anxiety and kind of coming to a place of, okay, something has got to change. My life is really unmanageable.
The awakening aspect of healing, what's that about? Is that what happens during the course of therapy?
It really was what happens once people get through the second stage of education.
Okay.
It's like, wow, these games that have been played, these things that I thought were normal or I thought were just part of every relationship or, you know, every sort of group or family, I've come now to realize that there's actually terms and understanding that these actions have words to them and definitions, and that the bigger thing is that many other people have experienced this as well. There's a real large online community support for recovering of psychological abuse. And, you know, folks plug into groups and they plug into other resources and they start to realize, I'm not alone. This is not just me. And that's the awakening stage.
The online community, that sounds like it's something that you would recommend folks participate in if it seems like a good fit for them?
Yeah, there's some really good groups, and then there's some that, you know, just like everything, can have their own issues. So I really encourage people to use discernment and just figure out what does recovery look like for them. But there are some Facebook groups, there's Instagram pages that really talk a lot every day about recovery and hope and how to find it and supporting one another. And if somebody finds a group online and it just doesn't quite have the right tone, there are many, many more. And there's some really good work out there being done.
Okay, so the good news in some of what we're talking about is that there is so much growing awareness and growing support for something that you can't look at and say, here's my Band-Aid, here's my proof.
Absolutely, yes. We are working very, very hard, and many advocates are, and many clinicians are, to, you know, go out and speak at groups like in the court system, the family court system, or to speak with other therapists. That's something I feel very passionate about, is getting to master's programs and schools and to other therapy groups, so that folks can understand that when they have clients come in that may be exhibiting some of these, you know, recovery issues, that they can identify psychological abuse victims. Because what ends up happening is that we use our traditional counseling methods, and it ends up bringing the survivor into some sort of ownership too early in the recovery. So, you know, all marriage problems have 50-50 ownership, right? But that's not true in a psychologically abusive relationship. So education is really important, so that at least folks can identify what their clients have been through if they're a therapist.
You know, I'd love to see more work done in the judicial system. So many times, as I know that you know this, so many times individuals who have been abused may wind up in front of a judge who, if he or she doesn't see what they consider to be evidence of abuse, they're going to toss the request out for a protective order or toss the case out, or just not understand how much true harm and potential ongoing danger that individual is in.
100% agree, yes. And even if it never, ever leads to physical, well, there's something that we talk about, even if it never leads to physical, all physical violence included psychological abuse ahead of time. But even if it never becomes violent physically, there is so much damage to systematically deconstructing someone's self-esteem. I mean, we just cannot minimize that factor. And I get it that people in the court system, judges and lawyers and other people, just don't understand it. I mean, as therapists, we're really emerging to understand the damage that is done from psychological abuse. But that's why we have to get out there and really start advocating.
Absolutely. In fact, you talk about in your book some of the experiences that you had, which included dropping out of school, dramatic weight gains and weight losses. So would you say that what you experienced is common for individuals who have gone through varying degrees of psychological abuse, or would you say that your experience was really unique to you, or both?
No, I think it's very common, and I think that there's a spectrum of, depending on, you know, how long the relationship happened, how much power, how much influence the abuser had. You know, I align it to someone joining a cult. Oftentimes, you know, people will come out of psychologically abusive situations, and we have to deconstruct a lot of the lies that were implanted and put in over time. And so just like that process can take time, so can psychologically abuse recovery take time. And I think my experience is not an extreme case at all. I think that the impact in, you know, when somebody grows up in a toxic family especially, there's no foundation, so the foundation has to be constructed. And we can see really clearly that when you grow up in a home that's very poisonous, it's only up from there. I mean, you really have a long way to go, and sometimes that takes a long time. So no, I don't think my needing to overcome so much from a young age is, you know, just sort of the one-off. I think it's very, very typical.
And particularly for those who grow up in the family, as you've said, where sort of psychological abuse is the order of the day, they don't necessarily have a frame of reference. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah, there's no frame of reference. And when they do possibly arrive, survivors arrive in a counseling office, the worst thing to hear from a counselor would be either from a religious perspective of, well, you know, you need to honor your mother and father, or from a non-religious perspective of, well, you know, all parents do the best they can. This is wholly and completely set apart and different from just being a normal parent, where we're like, God, I hope I'm doing this right, you know?
Right.
This, what we are talking about growing up in a poisonous environment, is completely different from all parents trying to do their best. This is calculated. This is scapegoating. This is, you know, operant conditioning, where we've got the back and the forth. This is brainwashing. This is completely different. And when people arrive in a therapist's office, the therapist needs to be able to recognize it. They may not treat it. They may need to send to somebody like me or someone else who specializes in it, but they need to not do more damage.
Okay. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about setting boundaries, which, as you know, is certainly not something that routinely happens in an abusive relationship. So that's where we'll pick up. Folks, we'll be right back. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Shannon, the concept of boundaries is actually kind of a dirty word for the person who is being abusive, for the psychological, for any abuser, but certainly for a psychological abuser. Boundaries are not the thing that they really think should happen. So
right.
How does one who has experienced psychological abuse begin to even think about the possibility of boundaries and a way that they themselves can actually institute them?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question. And I think that a lot of times therapists or family members or friends say, you know, we'll just do this and just do that. And it really is a component of why we have to go through these stages. We have to come to an awareness, or, you know, the despair stage. We have to get through the education. We have to have aha moments, so that when we arrive at boundaries, we know why we're setting them. We will not go from despair to setting boundaries. It never happens. And actually, there's quite a bit of discussion and research about the impact physiologically on survivors of psychological abuse, because there's a term called trauma bonding. So there's a lot from a physiological perspective with cortisol and adrenaline and some of the other, you know, trauma responses that no one is going to be able to just go from 0 to 100 of I'm in this and now I'm out of it. And so that's why we really have to recognize the stages, that boundaries is stage 4 of 6. And that takes a while.
You use the term trauma bonding. What is that?
Trauma bonding. Trauma bonding is the idea that when we've been in a relationship or in a setting where it's that operant conditioning concept, that back and that forth, that hot and that cold, that I'm giving you the attention, I'm giving you what you need, and then I'm pulling it back. And I'm using the silent treatment, and it's really that brainwashing technique to become dependent on the attention. It's much like a drug. You know, the body becomes dependent on the drug, and if it's brought back and forth, when the drug is received or the attention is received or the praise is received from the abuser, it feels so much better and so much stronger than would have been without the conditioning. And then the trauma bonding comes in, where we've got high levels of adrenaline, high levels of cortisol, sort of a physiological dependency on that positive attention.
The idea that, again, that one can actually establish boundaries and maintain mm-hmm. them. If the person with whom you have been involved is a family member, how do you do that? How do you set? I mean, what does a boundary look like if your abuser was a family member?
Yeah, and that's where I talk about in the book that for me, there's two different types of boundaries. That's called no contact and detached contact. And some people call it limited contact. I call it detached in the book specifically because just limiting time with somebody, if I'm still very triggered, is not very helpful. If I'm detached, I've worked through the stages, I've worked through the ability to recognize that this abuser, that they are having struggles. They are the one who are causing the problems. I'm no longer internalizing their lies. So if it's within a family, a lot of times people have to decide, okay, can I have detached contact for short periods of time with this family member without being triggered in any sorts of trauma response or feeling looped back in to the chaos? And then if people realize that they really cannot have any kind of contact, then whether it's family or not, health is the most important thing in our safety of ourselves and our own children, if we have any. No contact sometimes with family members is the only option. And that's why I recommend if people are, you know, able to go to counseling, able to sort through their individual story. But that was really why I wrote the book, was because I know some folks can't access counseling or don't know of someone who specializes in this, that this is the exact process we go through when we work with clients in person. And that's why the boundaries chapter really talks about different options.
So if you are in a family that on the one hand, I'll put it in quotes, values family and mm-hmm. and wants everyone to just get along, and they have the routine holidays and reunions and all of that, but a member of that family has actually harmed you, is it then reasonable and or okay to decide that you want to have no contact with any part of that family?
Yeah, and I think that the question then would be, if that person had harmed me, why is the rest of the family not addressing it?
Right.
If they value cohesion and they value attachment and they value health, are they sweeping under the rug and looking the other way? And there's a term called flying monkeys. And that's one of the terms we discuss in education, that if there's an abuser, is everybody in that family functioning as a flying monkey? And that comes from the Wizard of Oz connection, you know, how the witch had her monkeys to go out and, you know, do her bidding. So I would really question, how healthy is the family? Now, if the family has addressed the abuser and said, you will not treat any of our family members the way you did, here's boundaries, we're all supporting, then that's a safe environment. If that family is just sort of ignoring it and orbiting around this abuser and allowing it to go undealt with, then I think they all have some responsibility as to why they're not recognizing it and discussing it openly.
And then what does that individual do? Are they left with the choice of no family if they do not yes. believe that the family is really supporting their need to heal and to remain safe?
Absolutely. And there is a term, adult orphan. And sometimes if we come out of a toxic environment, you know, it's all about a scale. It's how much am I enjoying being part of this family and gaining from it and able to engage with them and them with me, and how much is harming me and I'm living lies, and it's actually quite poisonous on the, you know, behind the billboard living. People have absolute right to say, I will not go where I'm not welcomed and I'm not protected. And that sometimes includes then having to cut contact with family and create family among safe friends.
That's a huge decision to make, and that's a huge piece of behavior to sustain.
It is. It's a very, very big decision. And I think that when people get through the recovery stages, it's like you start to realize what health looks like, and it becomes very difficult to be in toxic environments. So it's not just going from, I want to be here, I'm really engaged, I want this family to work. It's going through those stages, you come to the awakening and the awareness of just how toxic the situation is, and then many people don't even want to be in it anymore.
Let's say you've got someone who's gone through the stages up until boundaries and restoration, and then you talk about maintenance. Is this like something that you have to treat yourself forever?
No, it's really about once you get through it, a lot of times people will go back to the other stages as they sort of heal at deeper levels. It's the awareness of where we've been. I think anyone that's been, you know, part of a cult setting in the past will always need to be aware that, okay, am I in a religiously healthy environment? And then how would I know if it wasn't? And so it's just that mindset of recovery, just like AA or any of the other recovery models, is how do I stay and maintain the beautiful life I've created? And so that's what maintenance looks like for me. It's that cultivating and that keep that health going, because it's very easy to fall back into old habits.
I see. Okay. You also make reference to smear campaigns. What's a smear campaign?
That's where a toxic person will set out to bring people to their side, so to speak. You know, toxic people like to create chessboards in their lives where they have all these people and they move them around as it's convenient for them. A smear campaign is when taking gossip to another level. So it's gossiping and planting seeds of doubt. If it's a work environment, it may be someone who kind of whispers things, and, oh, I don't think that person can handle this, or, you know, this person's really struggling with this project, or it's casting doubt in other people, or actually changing the way people see another person.
And love bombing, what is that?
That happens in the beginning of a relationship. It can mostly romantic, but it can also be in a work environment or a religious setting. It's where the initial meeting is happening, and they're trying to get all of the attachments quickly. The abuser is trying to get the person to let their guard down, to get all those sort of interesting love feelings going if it's, you know, in a romantic relationship. And so it's a very calculated bombing of, you know, we're so much alike and we're just really connected and I've never met anybody like this. And so that they can get behind the walls and they can get that person in love and attached to them quickly.
And then once they have, in their view, secured this individual, then they go about the business of being psychologically abusive.
Correct. And even the love bombing is abusive because it's not with genuine intent. It's not like two people who are just super excited about each other. It's calculated. It's for a different purpose. It's for manipulation. And so once that abusive stage, it doesn't look abusive, but it is because of its intent. It's just like someone who cons another person with the intent of stealing from them. So once that abusive stage is over, then it gets into the devaluing where they start picking and start, you know, complaining and start ripping apart all the things that they just said were such strengths. And then they move into the discarding stage, whatever that may look like.
And for the abuser, how do they see this as being helpful to them? What's their bottom line goal?
Great question. The bottom line goal is their needs.
Okay.
So they either were raised in a home where their needs were excessively met all the time, even to the not following our, you know, standards of law and things, like the law didn't apply to them, or their needs weren't met, and rather than becoming more empathetic to people who also, you know, have suffered other things, these folks come out of situations like that where their needs weren't met, and their needs are going to get met no matter what. So for them, they're never wrong. They're always the victim. Everyone's doing everything to them. And it is all about them all the time.
That sounds pretty exhausting.
It's dressed up a whole lot better. So, you know, their abusers don't abuse every day is kind of the difficult part. You know, there's good days, there's good moments, there's good times, but those are all fraudulent. They're just very short-lived. And so it doesn't feel exhausting until it becomes really clear as to what's happening in the relationship.
Is there a particular kind of person who is likely, more likely than others, to be a victim of psychological abuse?
Yeah, like I mentioned before, I think that really easygoing kind of like making lemonade out of lemons, a person who's really able to be self-reflective, who says, you know what, this person's telling me that I'm behaving badly or I'm hurting their feelings. I'm going to look at myself. I'm going to see if that's something I'm doing. There's a high empathetic nature. being able to recognize other people's needs, wanting to meet those needs. Empathy and codependency are very different. Empathy is a wonderful personality quality that we need more in the world of, but it can be exploited by psychological abusers. And then if that dance, that toxic dance starts, it can move into codependency.
Does it ever make sense to share with a psychological abuser your sense of the abuse that they are bestowing upon you? Are they going to hear that? Are they going to want to, of their own accord, do something different?
It is important for survivors to tell the truth of how they're feeling, depending on the safety level. Some folks, if they are clear and calm and point out the inconsistencies, that can then enrage an abuser and it becomes a very unsafe situation quickly. If that's not the case, then yes, it is important to describe what they're experiencing once, maybe twice. But beyond that, psychological abusers that are on that, you know, spectrum of narcissism and sociopathy, they don't want to change because they have no motivation to change because life works for them. If everything's about you, why would you change that?
So there, in fact, if you approach a psychological abuser and tell them that what they are doing is harmful to you or painful for you, that's, they're not going to particularly hear that.
No, and they may for a moment, I call it the turtle head, they may pop their turtle head out and go, yeah, you know, I really see it, you're right, I really need to make some changes. And then, whoop, the head pops back in and they make no changes at all. There's just short kind of moments for some of them that they will go, yeah, I can see that. There may even be tears. There's a high level of acting that goes on because if at a core level, I don't have normal attachments, if I'm an abuser, if I don't have normal attachments to people, I have to mimic what I think would be normal. So there could be crying, there could be remorse, looks remorseful. The biggest key is what is the lasting, sustained change in their behavior.
For the person who is saying to the abuser, these are the things that are hurtful to me, and the abuser appears to acknowledge that, I am so sorry, I didn't mean to, I will be different. In that moment, the person who's being abused can be really seduced into believing that that's what's really going to happen, that it really is going to be different.
Absolutely, 100% correct. And that's what ends up creating this sort of roller coaster. There's up, there's down, there's good, there's bad. It's the cycle of violence as well. There's, you know, the honeymoon, the buildup, the explosion. It's a little bit different when it's psychological abuse, but there's still that kind of up and down and up and down. And what I work with a lot of clients is deprogramming. You know what this roller coaster looks like. You know what the highs look like, and you know what the lows look like. And a lot of times they'll get off sort of the roller coaster with the person for a short, short period of time. The abuser will then sort of suck them back in, or something will happen, the relationship will start again, and the ride goes again, and it's the exact same ride every time. And survivors start to recognize that will never change. There will be the good times, but there will be these really terrible bad times as well. And that's what I'm signing up for if I continue in this situation.
Given the ability of the psychological abuser to not engage in that kind of behavior all the time, and to certainly come off as being warm and loving and just socially amazing and fabulous, it's got to be really, really hard for other people to acknowledge the pain that the harmed person is experiencing.
Yes. And that hinders recovery quite a bit. And that's why, you know, having words through the stage two education to describe exactly what gaslighting is and what we've, some of the terms we've already talked about, like love bombing. I have a letter in the back of my book that is to Dear Family and Friends, Your Loved One Isn't Crazy. That's the title of it, because a lot of family and friends looking in on this situation do not see it. They just physically and emotionally cannot see what has happened until the survivor either continues to give them resources and the family and friends really do some education. They start to go, okay, I get it now. Or the survivor has to get to the point where even if their, you know, family or some friends don't get it, they get it. And then they find other survivors who get it, and they find a therapist who understands. And so a lot of times there becomes a wall, unfortunately, that psychological abusers are able to create between the survivor and their support system because the support system doesn't see it.
Right.
That's part of the tactic as well.
I was going to say, which of course, I mean, just makes the abuse almost double and triple fold when the people you believe are there for you aren't able to be there for you for any number of the reasons, including those that you just indicated. So you feel even more alone, even perhaps even more abused.
Most definitely. And what will end up happening is if they go to a place of worship and try to get support, they may come out then with the original problem and perhaps even some spiritual guilt that should not be put on them. Or if they go to a therapist who really doesn't understand psychological abuse, then they're told they need to work harder in these relationships. And so that's why education and awareness and getting the word out that this is a real form of trauma, we just have to keep doing the work.
Shannon, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like for you to talk a little bit more about the spiritual piece and the religious piece. You've said earlier that you have some concerns about the way in which some churches respond to the specter of psychological abuse. So that's where we'll pick up when we return. Shannon, talk about those folks who, for social, cultural, religious, any number of reasons that are very dear to them, believe that they need to stay in a relationship no matter what. And for those folks, if they are a part of a religious organization that supports that, you have some concerns about that.
Yeah, I really do, and many, many, many advocates do, and many theologians do as well, because I think that, you know, we can look at scripture, and we can look at belief systems, and we can look at teachings of all different faiths, and there's different interpretations. And so for me, you know, as a clinician, I send people back to their place of worship, but that can be sometimes risky. And so what we really have to do, if I'm coming from, you know, a Christian perspective, because that's the community and the culture that I know, there's some strong things that we can discuss about evil and fools and evil people and boundaries that are in scripture. And so other texts and other communities can find, you know, their resources. But I am very concerned about people needing to get safe, not just because it's physically harmful, but because their personhood, like I said before, is being deconstructed and places of worship are guilting them back in and making them almost responsible for the abuse.
For those who are listening, those theologians, those pastors, those priests, those ministers who may not see what you're saying and really believe that if they guide their parishioners back into a relationship, that that is the thing to do, what would you like for them to think about as a way of helping them to help those who have come to them?
Yeah, that's a big question. And I think that the basic standard is that the Bible talks about boundaries. Leslie Vernick is a wonderful writer and advocate and counselor, and she's written a great blog and called Five Indications of an Evil Heart. Five Indicators of an Evil Heart is the title. And, you know, we need to be looking at scriptures that also talk about the fool and how to get away from the fool and how to set boundaries with the wayward. And I think that the concept of honoring the covenant of marriage when the covenant has been broken by abuse is really damaging people, and unfortunately I have a tendency to believe it damages more women, because I think we have a a stronger patriarchal, misogynistic message that gets happened, but men are spiritually abused as well. And my practice is equally men and women of survivors of psychological abuse, so this is not limited to gender. Within a church culture, though, it does tend to be women are told things like, if your husband's, you know, misbehaving and being dishonoring, if you are an honoring wife, he will change. And that is just a complete setup for codependency and for ownership of someone else's responsibility. So I think it'd be really helpful for pastors and people to recognize and remember that each person has agency over themselves, whether it's the husband or the wife, and hold them accountable equally.
Can you give us an example of some of the kinds of things that families might say when the families are engaged in psychological abuse? Some of the things they might say or some of the things they might do?
Yeah, there's a lot that they say of, you know, we love each other unconditionally, and that means you can't have boundaries. That's code for don't talk about the things that we do that are painful and harmful and abusive because we love unconditionally. And so there's this concept that, you know, we honor mother and father. That's another belief system. Sometimes it can be leaving people out. The silent treatment is used a lot in families where social media will be used as manipulation, where they'll post pictures of certain family members doing things, but they didn't invite the scapegoated or the targeted family member. There can be a lot of financial. Money is a big lever in families that are abusive that they will withhold for some that don't kind of toe the party line and don't do what the parents or toxic family want. And so it's about favor. It's about scapegoating a lot within the family.
When you say, let's talk a little bit about the money piece, because, you know, that gets to be very complicated all the time, every day. So if you've got a family who, let's say they have five children, and they've promised all five that they're going to help them with college, and then that's withdrawn from all five, would that be considered potentially abusive or no? Does it depend, I guess, on the reason? Yeah.
You have to know a lot more. If it's the, I mean, there's just so much more systematic behavior going on, whether there's been a financial, you know, shift that they can't do it anymore, or if it's about control of, I said I was going to do this, and now you're not who I want you to be. You're not pursuing what I want you to pursue. I would assume that that's not in a vacuum. That's probably just one symptom of probably thousands of other moments like that.
That actually makes a lot of sense. Now, so for the person who's listening now, who is at the beginning of recognizing that maybe they are being victims, they are being victimized by a psychological abuser, what's a first step you want them to take or want them to consider taking?
Yeah, the first step is a lot of self-care, making sure that they're eating, that they're sleeping, that they're reaching out to the support system, hanging out with people, being around folks that make them happy. That's the very first thing, because that is typically what is usually targeted sometimes by an abuser. Even in the workplace, they just pile so much on, and they get them traveling so much, and they get them doing things that they have no time to recharge. So that's like a today, I will eat well, I will take care of myself. And then really starting to do some research about psychological abuse. There's a lot online, not just support systems, but blogs and other types of resources that they can right now start looking at to be able to understand what they might be going through.
And I noticed that at the back of your book, there's a list of some of the resources that are available.
Yes.
The idea that one could be in a psychologically abusive relationship, but there are children in the household what do you want those folks to think about? Because, you know, so many times people say, well, you know, he might be bad to me or she might be not good for me, but this person is a great parent. Is that possible?
You know, it can be. I would say that they're not a great parent, but they're kind of a better human being to the children, maybe. You know, they may think a great parent then would be able to attach and to bond and be kind to the children's parent, other parent, the targeted parent. So sometimes I think when, you know, there's kids in the home, and I work with many people over the years who say, you know, there's no way that I can get out of this situation right now for a variety of different reasons, but it's not so poisonous up the spectrum that they are, you know, shutting down emotionally or shutting down physically. It's just really, really difficult. And that's when we look at detached contact for a season. And each individual dynamic and intricacies are so different that it's hard to give a blanket statement. But once people become aware of what the abuser does and the way they may favor children and the way they may use people and scapegoat other children, it's very, very helpful to have their eyes wide open to what they're seeing, because then they can make educated decisions.
Okay. You suggest that folks put a collage of positive symbols on their phone backgrounds. Why?
That's when people have come out of the relationship. That's when they've gone no contact, whether it be family or a romantic relationship. And it's really putting a collage of their, that's in the restoration stage, at stage five, or maybe at stage six. I'd have to go back and look. But it's really that reminder of what they've built, that they have been able to pull away through all of these stages and unravel from the abuser. And they need a visual reminder sometimes of, I will never go back. And here's what I've been able to create and what I've been able to establish for myself, and I need to protect it.
When the person has gotten to that point where they are able to really see that they have pulled themselves away from this environment and that they are on the path to healing, how often are they afraid that they'll walk right back into a similar relationship unawares?
Yeah, I think it's an initial fear. I don't think that once they understand and they've got a few, you know, sort of situations under their belt where they're able to set boundaries, then it becomes, they trust themselves quite a bit more. But I think initially it can be very worrisome of, well, how did I step into this ditch before? But then we remind them, okay, this is what happened, and this is how you were able to get yourself out, and here's what you're looking for. There's some key things as they move forward in life that they're much more aware to be able to spot twisting and turning and manipulation and control and all of those things. And so once they have lived recovery a little bit longer, they go, no, I'm okay now. I recognize that I will spot this going down the road.
So part of the healing and recovery, it sounds like, is really being able to appreciate one's own self and one's own awareness, one's own ability to see what's really in front of them, which was so challenged during the episode of psychological abuse.
Yes, it becomes a really peaceful and a really good time to be able to say, I didn't see what was happening then, because it's a con. The abuser doesn't want the person to see. So at any point that they would start to understand, then the abuser would change the game a little bit. But there were red flags. There were some things that should have been taken seriously and taken a little bit more to heart. And folks that are in recovery don't minimize those anymore.
For someone listening, give us who's at the beginning of considering that they too might be in the place of being abused, give us some more insights into what he or she needs to be on the lookout for themselves, some behaviors that they need to be able to identify within themselves that might be a clue that something's not okay.
Yeah, I think that it's the idea of, have they gotten to the point where they don't feel like they can make any decisions on their own? Do they feel like, okay, I need to, you know, check in with this person, or they feel like they're walking on eggshells, or do they feel like they've lost a sense of themselves, like they don't have the sparkle that they used to have if this relationship was not, you know, from family? There's really just, what's their quality of life? Is their life enjoyable, or does it feel like it's on a roller coaster? Does it feel like it's up and down and it's the roller coaster experience? I mean, it's really taking an inventory of, where am I? Do I feel like I'm hot and cold? Am I all over the place with this person?
When you come to the initial realization that maybe something is going on, that you need to reach out to seek guidance to wade your way through, how often is anger involved at self as well as others?
I think quite a bit. I think, you know, in the beginning, it's that turmoil. It's that up and down. I talk about, you know, that it's like a snow globe. Their whole lives feel shaken. And sometimes you feel like you're wondering, am I swimming to the bottom of the ocean? Or am I swimming to the top to get breath? It's a very disorienting time within stage one despair. And anger comes along with that. And the abusers like to push and push and push and push in a very covert way so that the survivor will explode or become angry, and then the spotlight comes on them. So that's a tactic that happens quite a bit. So some people will come in and say in the beginning, I'm angry and I'm exploding, or I'm yelling, or I'm so frustrated, and this isn't my core personality. I don't know what's happening to me. Well, as we start to unravel and we start to look at, do they have an anger issue? Because maybe they do and it just never noticed it. But in the world of psychological abuse, oftentimes it's the abuser who's pushing so that they can then blame the survivor for their own behavior, because then the spotlight comes off the abuser.
And then it sounds like it's even more motivation if the person who's being harmed accepts that spotlight, for them to take ownership for changing their behavior, for soothing the abuser, for doing all the things that actually the abuser wants them to do.
Yes. Yes, that's the complexity of psychological abuse right there.
The idea of children who are being psychologically abused, what do you do with that? I mean, children, 12, 13, 14, they don't particularly have the skills to even think about abuse in the way that you and I are discussing today. What are the signs? What can people do?
Yeah, that is an extra area of specialty, because a lot of times it ends up involving the court system, mm-hmm. Where they may not want to go on visits, and we've got some other dynamics going on that are very, very complex, and that actually moves out of my area of scope. But I can say that for those older kind of tweens and teens, I think even being able to recognize whether it's their peers or it's a parent, what does manipulative behavior look like? You know, how do they kind of stay core to themselves of what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, what does coercion look like? Because there's a lot of manipulative peers for them as well. So I think parents can talk about in kind of a global picture or a macro picture of how do you not give in to manipulation, but it becomes very, very complex when it becomes a parent, and that is then a whole other area of specialty, because how much agency really do teens have with a toxic parent?
Indeed.
And it becomes about, does the survivor parent need to leave and to, you know, set legal boundaries? It becomes very difficult, but I think at the core, it's about teens recognizing what does manipulation look like. Even if they are being manipulated by a parent, at least they can call it what it is and not be absorbing all that poison without any guard.
Gotcha. Shannon, there's so much more to learn about the experience of psychological abuse. Is there a website that folks can go to get more information about your book in particular?
Yeah, there are Southlake Christian Counseling is my business, and it's southlakecounseling.org. I have a Facebook page of Southlake Christian Counseling, and every day I post different pictures on picture quotes about recovery. And I have Instagram, which is at Shannon Thomas. And there's some really great advocates out there. We all kind of have a little bit of a different voice. And so once you start looking and finding one advocate, they often link to others. And it's just real important to find the voice of recovery that works for individuals. I may not be, you know, the right voice for everybody, obviously, but there are lots of great people out there that look at recovery from just a slightly different lens that are very, very sound.
Excellent. Shannon, thank you so much for spending time with us today, and thank you for creating this book.
Thank you. I really appreciate your invitation, and thank you for this time.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So send me an email, pamela@myndtalk.org is the way to be in touch. And remember, Mind MindTalk is available to you on demand by going either to the MindTalk website, again, MYNDTALK.org. You can download the MindTalk app from the iTunes Store or Google Play. There are lots of ways to be in touch, and I hope that you will do so. Folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.